Welcome back to Equal Time. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and the rest of the show today, we're going to be talking with Robert Riversong, designer, builder, and instructor of sustainable building at Yes Tomorrow, with the main question, when the economy is tanking and the world seems to have reached peak oil production, what would our world look like if it was sustainable? And Robert has a strong history for being able to address this question from geodesic domes in the 1970s and a community land trust homestead project in rural Maine in 1981. Robert has worked as a project manager, a trainer, and a consultant for nonprofit building projects from inner city Boston to the Hullers of Tennessee. He's worked on passive solar super insulated buildings. One of his design build projects received a citation for excellence in a national energy and resource efficient design competition. And coming up later this month, he's going to be teaching Thinking Like a Mountain, Sustainability from the Ground Up. Your phone calls, as always, are welcome. The number here is 244-1777, toll free 877-291-8255. We know our economy is not sustainable right now. It's built on cheap fossil fuels. They're rapidly running out, so something needs to change, and maybe mountains can give us the answer. I don't know. Robert, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Carl. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you on here. I've known you for a number of years now. I always found it interesting to talk to you, and glad to have a chance to share a conversation with our listeners.
Yeah.
So how do mountains think?
Well, if we take the time to spend some time and open ourselves to the silence of that space, we might rediscover that. Some of the most famous environmentalists, John Muir and Aldo Leopold, have given us some clues in that direction. In fact, it was Aldo Leopold's book, I believe, from 1949, the San County Almanac, which had a chapter in it called Thinking Like a Mountain, which is a pretty powerful and inspiring piece to help us re-perspective out of the anthropocentric view that we've evolved towards and back to a much more holistic ecological view.
I've got to confess, I didn't reread that chapter for today's show. It's been quite a few years since I've read it. Could you remind us what Leopold talks about in Thinking Like a Mountain?
Oh, gosh. It's been a while since I've read it, but I do have somewhere a reading that I share in my class. Just seeing if I can dig it up real quick here. I'm not seeing it right away. But again, it's really learning to think from sort of outside our skins, learning to think and more importantly to feel and experience life from the perspective of the whole web of life rather than just from our own narrow and subjective view. And it's something we've really lost. It's something that was, I think, pretty basic to human culture for most of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years of our evolution. But we've become so inwardly focused. And especially here, I think, in America, we're so proud of our individualism, so focused on our own individuality and our separateness, that we've not only lost touch with the broader web of human community, but even more so, I think, the web of life that we grew out of, that we are, and that we depend on so completely. So I think that's what Thinking Like a Mountain is about. It's reconnecting with that broader web of life.
It's reconnecting with a broad web of life, which sounds very touchy-feely, and more power to it for that. But also, just from reading this course description, it sounds like there's a high degree of numeracy required. Numeracy is sort of the numbers, the arithmetic equivalent of literacy. And right now, growing up in our world, we learn how to read our paychecks, read our passbook accounts and our 401ks, understand about unemployment figures and GDP and so on. But there are a whole bunch of other types of numbers which you teach the importance of in this course. Can you tell us about some of them?
Yeah, I start out with sort of the more mechanistic, technological, numerological approach, though we don't go much into the numbers and the math themselves in this class. I have several other classes I teach where we focus more heavily on that. But I talk about certainly some of the basic issues that we have to consider in our, especially in our built environment, which is mostly what we're about at Yes Tomorrow, about designing and building. Such issues as, the operating energy costs, which are typically considered in programs like Energy Star homes, but even more significantly in many cases, the embodied energy or embedded energy in the materials we use.
What does that mean?
The broader environmental impacts, often calculated in terms of life cycle analysis, from cradle to grave, what are the impacts of all the materials we choose to use and the methods, the techniques and technologies that we use in our artificial environment.
Can you back up a moment and tell us about embedded energy in the materials we use?
Embedded energy means the process in manufacturing energy from cradle to grave. For instance, concrete is a very popular building material. In fact, it's the second most consumed material on Earth after water.
Wow.
But we forget that the ingredients for concrete have to be mined from the earth, which is a very mechanically intensive and energy intensive process. And then to make the Portland cement from the limestone, it has to be heated at extremely high temperatures, thousands of degrees, which requires fossil fuel energy inputs. And then it's heavy material, so it has to be trucked. The Portland cement is often trucked long distances, but then mixed with usually locally mined gravel and sand. But that has the embodied energy of the process, the mechanism to take it out of the earth, in addition to the other impacts, the other environmental impacts outside of the energy itself. And then it has to be transported to the site, to our building site. So all this energy comes in the concrete, embodied or embedded into it, before it even becomes part, a building material for our home or whatever else we're constructing. And it's possible that a well-constructed home, perhaps an earth-bermed home that requires a lot of concrete in the buried part could, in fact, save a great deal of operating energy over the life of the house, and that's important. But we never subtract the initial embodied energy. If we start with an energy liability, then it might take years of energy savings, of operating energy savings, to pay back that initial energy liability. And that needs to be calculated in, and we don't generally do that.
That needs to be calculated in if we're looking at the carbon footprint of a given construction technique, given house, and also just thinking about future building materials that will be available to us. If the era of cheap energy is coming to an end, then those materials with high embodied energy, like concrete, will be harder to come by, harder to use for energy-conserving home building.
Absolutely. And as you pointed out, it's not only the embodied energy, but materials like concrete, and in part because of all the energy, the fossil fuel energy that goes into making them and moving them, have an enormous global warming contribution as well. Concrete has a larger global warming contribution than almost anything else we use in the house for building, and primarily because we use it by the ton rather than by the pound, as we do with most other materials. Hmm. There can be 15, 20 tons of concrete in just a typical house with a full basement.
Oh, Robert Riversong, you're teaching this course, Thinking Like a Mountain, Sustainability from the Ground Up, at the Yes Tomorrow School of Design in Warren, April 25th through 26th.
Mm-hmm.
What do you expect the students to come away with after this two-day course?
I'm hoping they'll come away with a completely different perspective on life and a completely different sense of direction for themselves, not only in their work but in their lives as a whole. And this will be the second time I've offered this class at Yes Tomorrow. I offered it last fall, and we always ask the students to evaluate the class, give us comments and feedback afterwards, and some of the participants said they felt it was a life-changing experience, and that is my hope and intent. Because looking at the numerical elements of sustainability, these sort of more technological, technique-oriented, and material-oriented elements are just the very beginning. I start there, But then I move into cultural issues, the broader environmental issues, the philosophical issues, and we get into some experiential exercises to actually give people an opportunity, show people how easy it is to reconnect on a personal level with the natural world and find answers to our questions out there. Questions that often perplex us when we try to figure them out on our own or just through the mind. In fact, there was a piece on NPR this morning I was listening to. They were talking about the positive benefits of learning poetry by heart. And it got me thinking, what do we mean when we say we learn something by heart, rather than by head, by mind? Mm. And I think this is part of what I try to get at in this, especially in the more experiential parts of this workshop, is that we need to reconnect with the world around us through our hearts and not just through our minds, through our brains, through our intellect. And we've lost that ability and that connection. And that's what we need to restore and rebalance with the intellectual.
Sounds like it'll be a mixture of work inside in a classroom and outside.
Yes, we'll start, in fact, outside with a sort of a little group initiative immersion experience before we even get into our heads at all. Then we'll go inside and talk and evaluate, talk about and evaluate what we just experienced. But a lot of it will be, slideshow presentation discussion. There'll be group discussions and brainstorms. Brainstorming is nice because it's, you get words and ideas out before you analyze them intellectually. Just, I'll let them out, and then we can look at them. But so it allows them a more free flow of creativity. And then, we'll do more. We'll finish up with more experiential exercises out in the woods, both as a group and individually. We'll spend some time alone with each of us with a tree that calls to us.
Are you going to be hugging that tree?
We're going to be circling it and sitting against it, looking towards it, looking away from it, as a focal point for our perception as the hub of a wheel to look out to the broader world around it, the natural world around it, and it really does inspire things, feelings, thoughts, emotions, sensations that we don't pay enough attention to in our day-to-day lives. So it's just a way to get people to open up to a new level of being, of perceiving and communicating.
We're talking with Robert Riversong. He's a designer, builder, and instructor of sustainable building at Yestermorrow School in Warren. April 25th through 26th, he'll be teaching Thinking Like a Mountain, Sustainability from the Ground Up. Well, sustainability is a funny word. A lot of people think it's been overused and misused and abused and lost some of its meaning. But basically, if a society is unsustainable, that means that it just won't be able to continue going on in the way that it is, and therefore it will stop going on in the way that it is at some point. So I think it's fairly easy to point at our present society and be able to talk about how it's unsustainable, but what are your thoughts, Robert, on what our world would look like if it was sustainable?
Well, there's a lot of discussion and dialogue, fortunately, around the country, around the world, and I think especially here in Vermont, on this topic, on the question you just asked, and it has to do with our personal choices, our lifestyle choices, really considering the impacts that our choices have on our neighbors, on our community, on the local economy, on the local ecology, and on the next, our progeny, the future of our society, our children, our grandchildren, or even beyond, as the Native Americans taught us, to the next seven generations. What are our impacts today on the next seven generations? So it involves, issues of lifestyle, of land stewardship and natural resource stewardship, and community, organic community growth and development. I hesitate now. I catch myself when I use the term growth, because that's become so central to our current paradigm and so problematic. This idea of growth equals success or growth equals prosperity. We've forgotten that nature works by a steady state economy, not a growth economy.
Mm.
So there's a, you know, the whole web of impacts that our choices make. The permaculture movement, I think, has sort of encapsulated this better than most others, looking at all the various aspects of culture and how they can be either problematic or beneficial, and both in, you know, immediately and in the long run. So, and as you said, you know, a society or a culture that's unsustainable, either it will burn itself out, which could even be, you know, result in the extinction of a species. You know, the human species are no more immune to extinction than any other, or it results in the extinction of the cultural paradigm that dominates that society, that species, and the birth or development of a whole new paradigm. And I think that's where we're moving.
Mm. Yeah, what's easy for me is to look at things and say, oh, this looks like it's probably pretty unsustainable. What's harder for me is to paint a picture of a society that, all things considered, considering the nearly 7 billion people on the planet, you know, this society is sustainable.
It is. It is difficult, and we do need to try to envision that to whatever degree we're able. But I think more significantly, because, as you say, it is so hard to see outside of our current box that we're so accustomed to, that perhaps it's more important just to identify the principles, you know, the brushes that would paint that picture. We don't have to have the picture yet, as long as we understand which brushes, which tools make sense to use to create that new picture.
That's certainly an important first
step. Words make sense to write that new story.
Right.
We don't have to have the story right away, and it's something we need to write, I think, collectively. so no one of us has the picture or the story.
Mm. 244.
But we need to come together and work on it together and just figure out what are the right tools, at least, that'll start moving us in that direction.
244-1777 is the phone number, toll-free 877-291-8255. We're going to Richmond, where Mary's on the line. Hello, Mary.
Hi, I've got a question related to, instead of concrete, what do we use, since it takes so much energy?
Sure.
As a permanent building, block, if you will, substance. And as it relates to the classes, I think they're a great idea, but we need more of them at a better price. Yes, tomorrow tends to be high in price, but I can't afford to go there. But anyway, if you could please answer that, thank you.
Thanks, Mary.
Well, just quickly, for the price, a weekend workshop is only $300, and almost all the feedback we get from our students is that the pricing is fair. So, but I can't speak to that any further. In terms of concrete,
just a minute, Robert. Is there any assistance available to students?
There is. There are alumni who have made donations to for scholarships to help people that can't afford it. So I'll ask. That might be available.
And VSAC, does VSAC apply to Yes Tomorrow courses?
I don't know that it does. People would have to call the office and find out.
And the website for Yes Tomorrow is yestermorrow, like tomorrow, but yestermorrow.org.
Mm-hmm. In terms of concrete, the simplest answer to that is to reduce the volume of it, the quantity of it that we use. I tend to build on shallow, frost-protected foundations, which has just a little concrete beam that sits on the surface of the ground or just below the surface. Requires just a small fraction of the amount of concrete in a full basement. And if we build super insulated, my houses are super insulated, passive solar, they require next to no heat. So it doesn't need a full basement for all the utilities. Even if you have central heat, everything will fit in one little closet. So you don't need a basement. And if we don't have so many things that we need to store, you know, we need to rethink our space requirements and whether we need a basement and how big a house do we really need.
Mm.
The easiest way to make a house more ecologically sustainable is to make it small.
One of the things that I've been trying to encourage people to increase the amount of space for in their house is food storage for canned foods.
Mm-hmm.
and for root crops in a root cellar. If you've just got a shallow foundation and not a full basement, where do you put your root cellar?
Well, that can be outdoors. It could be under an outbuilding. There are other ways to do it, other spaces to do it. It doesn't need to be inside the house. Mm. But you could have, like they did in older New England houses, a partial basement, you know, a hand-dug partial basement for a root cellar just in one corner, mm-hmm. without, you know, a full basement. There are alternatives. There are options.
Mm. And the old days, some people used to just dig barrels into the ground and put the roots mm-hmm. in there. Although I was talking to someone who did that here one season, and he said they forgot about where they'd buried the barrels, and come spring they had bush. So that wasn't terribly practical.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this course is being taught, Thinking Like a Mountain. It's being taught April 25th and 26th. You can register at yestermorrow.org. What else would you like to tell us about what you're going to be doing in this course, Robert?
Well, we are also going to be exploring some of the issues I've mentioned, land stewardship. I've been involved for many years in the community land trust movement, which is based on the sort of the Native American principle of non-ownership, of stewardship, the Gandhian principle of village ownership or village stewardship of land, and even draws some inspiration from the Israeli kibbutz movement, the collective ownership of land and resources. We're going to discuss that. We're going to look at the whole history of the sustainability movement, how it is, right from the beginnings of the environmental movement here in the U.S. and globally, how it evolved, who were the principals involved in it, what were their philosophies, why did it evolve in the way it did. We'll critique some of it, some of where it's gone, and look at where it could go.
Do you want? It's a 2-day course. Do you want people to stay overnight, or is it a 9-to-5 type thing?
It's there'll be 3 sessions on Saturday. It's morning, afternoon, and evening, and then 2 sessions morning and afternoon on Sunday. It ends at 5 p.m. Sunday, and there's an optional prelude, a film on Friday night for people that can make it 7 p.m. Friday evening. I'm going to be showing the wonderful documentary, What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire. It's a 2-hour documentary made by filmmakers who have since moved to Vermont.
We're about out of time there. So, mm-hmm. Robert Riversong, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find out more about this and other Yestermorrow courses at yestermorrow.org. We've been talking with Guido Masse and Robert Riversong about different ways to approach healthcare and building and just about everything in life. I'm Carl Ettner. That's it for today's Equal Time. Travin's in tomorrow, Wednesday and Thursday. Anthony Polina will be in. Don't forget to check equaltimeradio.com for podcasts of the show that Travin and I do. Artie Levine produced the show. Stay tuned for music with Jack Donovan. Thanks for tuning in.